Hey, welcome to our latest episode of If You've Come This Far, where Sean and I get to talk to interesting people. Coincidentally, this very morning, we just got off the call with Dr. Daniel Ellenberg, who Sean will say more about, but we also published our most recent episode with Ashanti Branch. And in both cases, I was reminded of how great it is that we get to do this, to talk to these people. And so please go listen to the Ashanti Branch conversation, which was great. I think if you're behind like we are, let me put it that way, you might have some catching up to do. But let's hear. Daniel Ellenberg is fascinating. I just met him this morning. But Sean, tell us a little bit about this.
Do you think Daniel's going to be bummed out that we're promoting Ashanti's episode in his episode at all?
Well, Ashanti's has come first. And
right,
it follows.
But, yeah. So I just want to make sure that if you've already listened to that, great. If you haven't, listen to that, but also listen to Daniel, because
absolutely. Yeah. When these two guys, it turns out, are in touch with one another, and I think
they are
with one another.
Yeah, they are. Right. We are.
We're pulling in the same direction.
Bringing the whole band together.
The whole band.
Dr. Daniel Ellenberg, psychologist, former president of Division 51 of the American Psychological Association. Guy that I've been working with now, and it's going to be close to a year, on this concept of compassion as a kind of a focal character trait for men and boys moving forward. And that, if we can foster more compassion, and he likes to say for and from boys and men, then life would be, or the world would be, a better place.
And he did invoke the words of one of my favorites, I suspect one of yours too, Coach John Wooden.
Right.
So yes. So he had me at that for sure. But he was lovely and so smart.
Yeah, very, very smart guy. And as you'll talk about, he and I are working on a program, Strong Boys with Heart, where he talks about, and he didn't talk about it, but it during our conversation, but for him, he talks about this moment that really gets to him, which is, the boys are loving and friendly and holding hands with their friends and hugging. Mm-hmm. And then something switches. They're not supposed to be that way. I mean, you know how it is. We kind of grew up with that, which is you don't do that shit anymore.
And it's so, not cool, or it's not strong.
It's not cool.
Yeah.
And still there's an underlying homophobic aspect, I think, of this that still creeps in. And what he wants to do, he says, okay, in that moment, how do we bridge this youthful love that we have as we go through puberty, or as we enter our teens, or what have you? And so, yeah, that's kind of informing this work on Strength with Heart. With boys,
and real quick, Men Living and Daniel Ellenberg are doing what together?
We're developing this program called Strong Boys with Heart, where we want to go into elementary schools and just kind of be an example for boys, and have the kind of conversations we have in Men Living circles with young boys, just about, hey, talk to us about what you're experiencing, what your life is, and begin these practices now versus, when we're 40 or 50.
Yeah. Amen. Yeah. Like us.
Right. Yeah. Right.
All right. Well, it was a great conversation.
Yeah.
He's writing a book right now, and we've talked about him coming back with his co-author of that book. So you'll hear from him again, but I think you'll enjoy this conversation.
I think so too.
Good, good, good. Hi, Chris. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Daniel. I've in researching you, I've seen some clips of you, and I wasn't sure if you were going to show up with a beard or without a beard. And so,
right. Oh yeah,
I thought, like, I don't want to be like you guys.
Smart.
No, it.
I look. It's like, look at people are either an example or a warning. You guys.
Here's the deal. Seriously, though, it's so funny that you bring that up, because I never know with him what day I'm like, wait, you just had a full beard a day ago. How are you like now not?
No,
like,
you had a full mind a day ago. I didn't.
Oh, Jesus. You never know. Right.
Clean shaven, by the way. But yes, besides that,
I know.
I had a goatee. I didn't have a full beard.
Right. No. I know. But some days you might have a full beard, and then some days it's just so, I don't know how you do it.
You know, I just hope we're not recording now.
Oh, yeah,
we're,
we are.
We're recording. Oh, yeah, yeah, we captured all this.
We go cold right away.
We're really done now, aren't we?
That's it. That's it. I love that. People are either an example or a warning. Yeah, we should put that in our byline, right? Like, yeah, listen to us to see what not to do.
What we do is we pick guests, and then it's up to the audience to decide, okay, are there an example or a warning? And I'll tell you right now.
That would be a really interesting show, wouldn't it?
Like, it would be.
Example or warning. Like, for some people, there would be a warning. The same person would be a warning. For other people, like Andrew Tate is a warning to many people. He's an example. You know, so it's like,
yes.
You know, what's your perspective?
Yeah, for sure.
Chris, where are you located?
I was going to ask you the same thing. I am in Chicago. Well, I'm actually in Evanston, Illinois right now, but I live in Chicago.
Okay.
How about you?
I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. I'm actually from New Jersey. And I know it's hard to tell because I don't really have an East Coast type of personality. I've been in California a long time. I'm super mellow.
That's not really true. And you've only known him for 2 minutes, so the rest of the listeners will know.
There's still
Jersey will be here before you know it.
Yeah. Well, as they say, you can take the boy out of Jersey, right. But
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And where in the Bay Area are you? Are you in San Francisco or are you
in Marin County?
Oh, okay, great. Anyway, it's super great. I've been hearing lovely things for the most part, except when Jersey comes up. But Sean has mostly nice things to say about you.
Well, Sean and I hit it off right off the bat.
We did. So why is Daniel here, actually? There's so much for us to talk about today. So Daniel's an interesting cat. So
I'm much more like a dog.
Right. Okay. Right. But I think, and we'll grow from this, but, I got introduced to Daniel, by Joe Conrad, who among other things started Man Therapy. And, Daniel was, doing a day of conversation about compassion and wanted to promote it through Men Living. And so we pitched that. He and I started talking about, okay, what is this thing? And all of a sudden I became, you know, part of the movement, as Daniel will talk about, the movement of compassion, men and boys compassion. And so I think it's a really interesting topic for us to talk about. And Daniel, maybe a starting point, you can start wherever you want, but maybe a suggested starting point is why compassion? Why start this whole concept? I mean, I know you're involved with Rick Hansen, the Global Compassion Coalition, but maybe kind of tell the audience why that's so important in your mind.
Well, let's first of all take a look at what exactly is compassion. And compassion's been understood in different ways, but basically some commonality, which is essentially at least two different parts to it. One is an awareness that someone else is suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And two is a genuine desire to help alleviate that suffering, a movement toward that. Now, many times in life, you can't do anything, mm-hmm. but at least it's your positive sentiment. Now, that same compassion becomes self-compassion when it's directed toward oneself.
Mm-hmm.
So that much of life is really about dealing with pain. I mean, let's face it. Every day, each of us face different things that are painful. Now, if you think about pain and suffering, one way of distinguishing them is pain is what you actually experience. Suffering is what your mind kind of winds up doing with that. And to suffer means to carry from behind. So I start to ruminate, you know, about different things. And in life, there are, let's face it, a lot of different threats. Now, some of these threats are real. In a sense, someone's got a gun to your head. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to ever experience that. They're like literal, it's super obvious as that's a threat. Others, and most of the others, are in the mind, you know, mm-hmm. what we make up. with this, and we tend to ruminate as human animals, or humanimals, as I like to call us. Mm-hmm. And so compassion is really one of those really core human traits that I believe is the most important, or one of the most important, at least, to really cultivate in oneself, in one's group, in one's clan, in one's nation, in the world. Mm-hmm. And yet, at the same time, when we look at men and male psychology, it hasn't been a concept and or a practice necessarily that's been kind of hearkened as this is really part of the male condition. There was a Pew study done in 2018 where they were looking at core American values, and I won't go into all the other values, but the one I want to talk about is compassion, where it was looked at positive versus negative trait for women, positive versus negative trait for men. And compassion, it turned out, was seen as a super positive trait for women, mm-hmm. but a negative trait for men. Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
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 It's absolutely insane.
Yeah.
And so there are guys out there who actually feel empathy for many different people and situations, but the expression of that empathy, which is to feel with and feel for someone else, the expression of that empathy somehow does not sit well with their ideas about being masculine. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of hold it back. I think that the other person should kind of tough it out or whatever that happens to be. So, but the thing is that I find most, bizarre is that guys are really compassionate. If you really take a look, at what happens, even in sports, somebody has an injury, they're all around this guy. I remember in the Olympics where there was a gymnast who fell off of the horse and he was devastated. And then it was like the one opportunity. It's crazy, the Olympics, right? For once every no pressure there, right? Falls off the horse and he's crestfallen. He's sitting on the bench, like the proverbial head between his legs. Mm-hmm. One of his teammates comes up to him. He sits down and he puts his arm around him. Mm-hmm. Right? And then this guy, he kind of like, and you could just see that. Like, no words were necessarily exchanged, but they didn't need to be. Mm-hmm. Because that was an expression of compassion. But we don't call it compassion. And I think that's really unfortunate, because I think that on the male side of things, which I'm sure we're going to be going quite a bit into, it is very important for boys to learn to continue their compassion. And I say continue rather than just learn, because I think we're naturally wired to be compassionate, but it actually gets conditioned out of us. Tough it out, don't show vulnerability, be cool. You don't need any help. You're fine the way you are. Oh, come on. I don't need anything from you. Come on. No one's an island. It's insane. And I think it contributes to some of the poor mental health outcomes that we see in boys and men. Everywhere you look, there's some of that conditioning that is really, at the core of what's problematic.
And so is our goal, or should our goal be one of our goals, I should say, should be to change the perception that this is a negative characteristic?
Yes. And one of the big questions we've had at the Men and Boys Compassion Coalition, which is a group I started about a couple years ago, 2+ years ago, is really, do we just not even use the word? Mm-hmm. We have it in our title at this point. But do we just not use the word, which is, that ship has sailed, or do we actually help educate about what it actually means? And that has been our choice. And there are various men's organizations that don't use the word. And I don't judge them or blame them for not using it. They're aware of the kind of public perceptions and problems with how the word is seen as somehow you're showing it's weakness, it's a fallacy, you're compassionate because you're not strong enough. There are many disclaimers for it, But we really believe that we have to just basically highlight that, because ultimately, I mean, I believe, and this may sound a bit extreme or hyperbolic, that we're screwed on this planet. We may be screwed anyway. But if we don't develop more compassion, I don't know how we move forward, because it just seems like we're, you know, creating or focusing on some of the less stellar aspects of human nature, and that we need to really become more aware of others and to be, have a concern, you know, for others, including ourselves, you know, being kind, kindness is not weakness, you know, and I think that there's just these weird neuroassociations that help people have beliefs that lead them to behaviors that are, you know, problematic in the extreme, but at least not helpful, mm-hmm. you know, kind of situationally.
Where should we prioritize our focus? Where do young boys get taught this or get conditioned this way? How much of it is at home? How much of it is in media? How much of it is at school, et cetera? Or do we even need to distinguish?
Well, it's everywhere. So, you know, to your point, Chris, it's all of those different areas. It's there, and it's uneven, you know, in terms of how it shows up in different boys' lives. I mean, for example, you know, one kid may have super compassionate parents who don't push him and don't, you know, tell him to boy up or man up, you know, eventually toughen up. They don't do that, and they don't believe in that. But he winds up going to school where he starts getting that. Mm-hmm. You know, and like, for example, I have a colleague in my American Psychological Association division. He's written a book for teenage boys. He's really sweet, wonderful, strong guy, human being. And he's got a four-year-old son who's never done any of that, nor is his wife. But he goes to school, and some older kid starts calling him, you look like a girl, you know, like you're so mm-hmm. girly. And then he's hurt, gets wounded. And this is how boys start to develop this boy. No, I'm not like that, because, you know, it's threatening to be shamed and potentially physically violated because you're demonstrating characteristics that are triggering to other boys and men, because it reveals a certain level of humanness or vulnerability that they themselves have had to push under because they got the message. This is how it happens. I mean, it's mm-hmm. like the boy box turns into the man box. The man box comes back, you know, toward boys and tells them, come on, guy, you know, toughen up. So it's part of this kind of recursive system that it's hard to, in some level, go like, where did this start, and where, how do you intervene in this incredibly complex system? And Chris, you were, to some degree, pointing out the complexity, because is it school, is it parents, is it media? And the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. You know? And so I, as someone who's been involved with this stuff for over 40 years right now, I really thought it was going to be a very different world. When I look back, when I was really getting involved in the 80s, that's the 1980s. That I thought, oh, this is going to be so much more enlightened. But like many things in life, I was wrong about that. And nonetheless, it's kind of like either join the dance or you sit it out. And, you know, I just think we need to join the dance and really say that, hey, you can be a strong guy who's heartful. And this actually, Sean and I are really, excuse me, are working on a program which we are calling Strong Boys with Heart. You know, that really emphasizing that boys and ultimately men, you can be strong and heartful. I'm co-authoring a book called Strength with Heart. You know, it's called Upgrading the Male Operating System. You look like you want to say something, Chris.
No, I'm eating up everything you're saying. I would ask sort of as a segue, but in this program that you guys are doing, I would argue that I've seen in men living groups a sense of relief when men find out that it is okay,
right,
right? Like because we've been conditioned that it's not manly to be compassionate or whatever. And finally, when you realize, oh, it's not only okay, you're a better person for it. I know you as a psychologist and in all the programs you run, you work with so many men and boys. Have you had the same experience?
Totally. I facilitated weekly men's groups for 40 years. I just stopped doing that last year. And what you said, Chris, is absolutely 100% true. And it's interesting. There was a recent Pew study done where had values about men expressing kind of more open, vulnerable feelings. And independent of political orientations, men saw that as it's unfortunate that society doesn't value male expressions of vulnerability. They saw it, and it was more kind of democratic side saw it more than Republican, but still there was an awareness that it's unfortunate that as a culture, we're devaluing those tendencies, you know, those human proclivities. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's very interesting is that, but what we're seeing then is that men within themselves, most, actually see that as a positive trait. However, there are threats for doing that in the culture. And so you kind of go like, huh, well, it's not necessarily that someone holds a belief that guys are always supposed to be tough and strong and never have any doubts and everything like that. They may, within themselves, know that's not so great. That's not a good thing. But they also at the same time know that it's not safe or believe that it's not safe to express, you know, that hurt my feelings when you said that. Mm-hmm. Or it was bothering me when such and such happened. Or I'm really scared my wife is going to leave me. Or I'm, you know, really think I screwed up as a father. Or the multitude of different pains that people have in life. But what I've found, and obviously what you're finding in Men Living, is that when you get guys together and you change the rules, for me, this makes me emotional because I so deeply believe in this. I've had so many experiences of guys opening up and being loved and supported and respected for that. And I think, freak, man, I want the world to be that way.
Mm. I think it's, you know, one of the things that Daniel and I have talked about a lot, and that is this idea that, in fact, it's separate, you know, if you will, masculine energy versus feminine energy. What the hell is that even? I've never, you know, connected to my divine feminine. I don't know what the hell that is. So the bifurcation of emotion or personality or character or what have you, in and of itself makes it difficult to say, okay, why do we even have to separate these things? I mean, we're human beings, we come into the world, and this is just the way we're going to be. And so, and how do we begin to normalize that rather than, you know, creating this separation of, because, you know, even this idea of, you know, we talk about a boys program to go into elementary schools and, you know, just be an example and have a conversation with boys about what it means to be, actually to be a human. Are those conversations really going to be any different than it would be if it were fourth grade girls? I mean, I mean, why does that have to be a different conversation even?
Well, they have to be different because of where we've come from, right? Like we're trying to, in a perfect world, my sense is that there shouldn't be different sets of rules. I mean, maybe a few here, I don't know what they would be, but like when it comes to compassion, it should be the same sort of rubric, you know, for men and women, boys and girls, you know, non-gender conforming, anybody, because it doesn't matter. But because I feel like the work that Daniel, you're doing, and that Sean, Men Living, that we're doing, we're trying to correct some some bad things that, that we've let happen.
Yeah. And you know, we're not going to change the past. So it's like, okay, so acknowledge that that's the case. And obviously those practices still occur. So, you know, how can we continue to all offer an alternative, that, you know, that is attractive?
Yeah. I mean, when you look through an evolutionary lens, it makes sense. If you go back to tribal life, tribes, clans, groups, you know, where survival was an everyday reality. Now, obviously, it's still an everyday reality for many people on this planet right now, but it was certainly there, and much of it was about threats from wild animals, starvation, and other tribes. You know, so the men would be naturally... men tend to be bigger and stronger. I mean, like, that's kind of inarguable. Biological fact. And they are stronger physically, not always. I mean, obviously there are bell curves with this. Some women are stronger than some men, but tendencies wise, I think it'd be foolish to deny that reality. Just like I think it's foolish that some people these days in this upside down world are, you know, saying that men and women are exactly the same, and, you know, that there aren't really differences. And when you look at these statistics and characteristics, or, you know, and you can say that to some degree, but I think it's just naive to act like, you know, hormones and biology don't have impact. They do have impact. That's stupid, frankly, I think, to deny that reality. But one of the big problems is that we tend to view differences within this better, worse, superior, inferior framework.
Yeah,
that's the issue to me.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about true diversity, diversity, equity, and inclusion in an ideal world, it would be that we're respectful and appreciative of differences, and we're not constantly going, this is better, this is worse. Now, there's a part of the human mind that has a proclivity toward making distinctions of better and worse. And that's part of what we have to deal with as human beings. And that's reality also. But there clearly are differences. So it made sense for guys to be the hunters back then and for women to be the gatherers. You know, that from a physical perspective, and women, you know, unlike men, have children, you know, and, you know, obviously you're taking care of the child, you're feeding the child. It makes sense from a very practical perspective. But as you keep expanding in the growth, you know, of the world, it makes decreasing sense. And this is part of what we're facing right now, you know, which is that the skills and characteristics and traits that lead towards, you know, success in the outer world these days are much more relational, you know, are not based on physical strength. I mean, guys were showing their valor and their cojones, you know, through physicality. Now, there are some who do that for a living these days, but it's a very small percentage of men who can actually get status and power and prestige from their physicality. It's still respected on one level, but it's like athletes maybe and certain blue collar jobs, absolutely. But again, guys just haven't adjusted, you know, to the new reality, and that what brought up male status historically is just not the case anymore, which is part of why we see boys and men doing so terribly. Because essentially, if you look at resilience, which is how you handle disruptive, unwanted changes, you have to keep adjusting to that. You know, if you keep pushing through, and that's part of the male mentality, you push through that, you know, and, you know, if all you have is a hammer, you know, everything looks like a nail, as it's been said, you have to expand your toolkit. And that's really what we're talking about. We're saying, like, guys, to be resilient these days, you need to open up your mindset and open up your skill set, you know, to really navigate the world effectively these days.
This podcast is about being real with each other. And sometimes that means admitting life is hard. That's where our friends at Mental come in. It's a wellness app with tools and support for life's messiness. No toxic positivity, no gurus, just personalized, affordable, science-backed tools rooted in real-life coaching. So if you've been thinking, I should probably do something for my mental health, maybe this is that something. Visit getmental.com/IYCTF to give it a try.
Sean, I would love to take a quick detour here.
Yeah.
I know there's always stories behind everybody. And Daniel, you getting emotional talking about the importance of compassion sort of confirmed something I thought I knew about you before having met you. But like, what is your backstory? I mean, I know you worked as a psychologist. Maybe you still do, or at least that was your first real job, it sounds like. But like, When did this kind of thing start to matter to you?
Who knows? I always find it interesting when someone asks a question, which is a great question. It's a fair question, so no criticism of that. But there is a term that I think about quite often, which is called confabulation. To confabulate, like, oh, well, it's because of this, it's because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Who freaking knows? You know what that was. So given that, I'm going to give you my best confabulated answer.
Please do.
to your question. I think going back to childhood, I saw my father be very emotionally abusive with my mother and brother in particular. He was sarcastic with me, but he wasn't nearly on the level as he was with them. Now, he died when I was 10, mm-hmm. So, and I actually saw him die. I saw him fall down like a bowling ball and die from a heart attack. That's a part of what's launched my life and career, as it's turned out. But I always had this sense with him that he was really a sweet person, but he didn't know how to do that. He didn't know how to bring that out. He would be that way. He would hold me at times in a very sweet way, but he just couldn't seem to muster that in life. And it turned out that his father, who I didn't know, he died when I was 2, was a very, very abusive to his mother. So he witnessed that, and we tend to do what we've witnessed or was done to us, or some combination, of those. And so I witnessed this very abusive emotional turmoil childhood where there was not a lack, there was a lack of emotional safety. And I was a very sensitive kid, and by the way, by saying I was a sensitive kid, that's actually one of the criticisms that gets, oh, you're so sensitive. Yeah. And that's not exactly a compliment.
Especially in New Jersey, right?
Right.
New York is not far behind, I would say. But it turns out in many parts of the world, it may not be stated overtly like that, but there is that sense about guys being too sensitive, and that sensitivity is a sign of weakness, et cetera, like that, so you don't want to be sensitive. But that is how it all kind of fits together, this crazy mosaic of a nutty system, which, makes sense. So I kind of had a heart, but I really closed my heart and I got tough. And I wasn't one of these kids who was like, hi, will you like me? I became bully-ish. I got bullied some, but I bullied. I played sports. I wasn't, some guys kind of come to this dance where they're completely not, they don't feel like a guy, and like, I wasn't one of them, but I feared I was one of them in a way. So I just somehow kind of wended my way, through life. And I found that I started kind of testing people out. Like, could I say this? Like, what do you think about being in this clique? And doesn't feel like super safe. I wouldn't say safe, but we talk behind each other's backs. I was in a group of guys and we'd rip each other, and people weren't exactly very kind and sweet and sensitive. you know, to each other. And I always had a part of me that knew there was something off with that, but nobody was talking about it. Mm. It was just part of the fabric. It was woven right in. And just over time, basically, I started feeling more and more pain. There's a term being dystonic, like who I was inside, how I felt, how I was behaving, how I was relating, and how the world was super different. And it wound up, again, this I'm totally abbreviating, leading me into therapy when I just turned 20, when I felt like I was on the verge of a nervous breakdown. Mm-hmm. And my first therapist thought that also. I'm glad he didn't tell me that in the first session. You're like, you're going to wind up. You're the sickest. Fortunately, he didn't say that to me.
So were you studying therapy at the time? Or were you studying like?
Not at that time. At that time, I was a sophomore in college and was thinking about dropping out. And you know, since my family's getting money from the GI Bill and we would have gotten cut off if that happened, my mother convinced me not to drop out. And so I didn't, but if you could drop out of college, you go to therapy. It was a tough choice. You know, so I wound up seeing this therapist for 2.5 years and left Boston at the time. But I slowly kind of worked my way through, you know, this. And, you know, I continue to. I mean, these things are deep and they're very core. They're part of one's early brain development. So I find that I'm continually, even at 71 now, working that edge of how much do I reveal and what do I say and how do I deal with my own sensitivities and how much do I say to people. And, you know, I have created a world where I can say, if not everything or anything, just about to a huge amount of people. I have a massive network of people I can talk to. And I don't feel like I have to hide my doubts and my insecurities and sensitivities and all, because I created a world where that's cool in a certain way, or at least it's acceptable.
Yeah. Well, did you experience anything with that first therapist who must have been a good therapist because he helped you out quite a bit, it sounds like, to make you think, oh, this is what I want to do, or I'm good at this, or I have the skills to be helpful like this man has been to me, assuming it was a man?
It was a man, actually. It's an interesting story. I was uncertain about what profession to go into. And junior year, you know, of college, you're supposed to choose a major and all that kind of stuff. I'd already think about political science, religion, philosophy. And so I was always thinking about different things. And of all people, and this is truly shocking, my mother suggested, she said, you know, you've always been interested in people, in talking about things. Why don't you become a psychologist? Mm-hmm. And she was short on insight, shall we say. But in this moment, she was quite on to something. Mm-hmm. And when she said that, a light bulb went off. Mm-hmm. Never turned off since then. Yeah, I've got different areas. I'm not so interested in doing therapy with people right now, but I've always been interested in the psychological makeup of people and how to galvanize people. And that's part of what I'm, you know, focusing on right now. It's like, how do you actually collaborate and connect and care and be compassionate and kind, you know, with people and do cool things? I mean, part of my connecting with Sean, you know, is that we see things, if not completely identically, you know, very close, you know, and so we've just very, very quickly connected around, okay, we have a sense of shared mission, which is, it's an awesome thing. And as someone who is now involved with the Men and Boys Compassion Coalition said to me when I met him, I love this. He said, when you're 4 years old, all you need to have as a friend is someone who will crayon next to you. Mm-hmm. As you're an adult, for friends, it's best to do projects together. Mm-hmm. And it made sense to me because I look at the people who are involved in my life right now, aside from my old friends, I'm not necessarily working with, I'm not, you know, they're just old friends and we're disconnected and we're going to be friends. Pretty much every new person in my life in the last, I don't know how many years, I've done some type of work. I had some type of a shared sense of mission, you know, in the world. And I do believe that what I think we need much more of in the world is these groups forming, you know, who have shared sense of mission and together change the world. You know, because I've had this vision of a men's or a male compassion movement, you know, where guys, you know, can be cool and kind and connected, you know, essentially. And I know that in Men Living, you know, I don't know if you use the word compassion as a core part of your mission. I don't think you do, but it clearly is. You know, it's just,
but part of what you want, part of the mission is that organizations like us will use it explicitly, will be more outwardly communicative of that issue. I, you know, you're talking about collaboration and effort. And I want you to take a couple of minutes and just talk about your collaboration with Fred Rabinowitz on your book, Strength with Heart. And you, however you want to talk about it, but I'm curious about what does it mean to be, you know, strong with heart? What's your goal? What's yours and Fred's goal for this book?
Well, it's probably more than a singular goal, you know, in that regard. But before, when I was mentioning about good and bad and superior and inferior, and it's kind of a binary way of thinking, like if we're helping boys and men, we're hurting girls and women. If we're helping girls and women, we're hurting boys and men. It's like, I for the life of me, I just find it bizarre. Mm-hmm. That we tend to see the world in such simplistic ways. And I'm talking about some really smart people. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, who just like, it's like, what? So when I was president of my American Psychological Association Division on Men and Masculinities, I dealt with so many people who were kind of like, these are the men's rights people. They think of feminists are the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, and the men's rights people think, you know, that if only feminism was gone, that boys and men would be fine. It's like, that's stupid. You know, if you know, for the, you know, the guys who are the feminist-oriented guys, you know, who call themselves pro-feminist, fine, you know, I'm not making some statement pro or con about feminism. You know, they saw the men's rights people as the enemies. I've dealt with a lot of these different people, and they're just like the very simplistic way of looking at it. And I think when we look at in terms of strength and heart, that it falls into that kind of category, that guys are strong. I am strong. I am honorable. You know, I'm the Hulk, you know, and some of the mentalities that we see in the world, even sociopolitically, there is like strong. We don't take shit, you know, uh-huh. or everyone else. But we're not heartful.
Yeah.
But we're heartful, and we're kind of effeminate, and we're nice, but we don't have a backbone.
Uh-huh.
You know? And it's like, it's so limited and stupid, you know, in my mind. Excuse my being judgmental, but the reality is I am judgmental, uh-huh. you know, about uh-huh. it.
We all are.
Very frustrated. Uh-huh. About it. Uh-huh. And so I had this image decades ago, really, of Strength with Heart. I called my men's groups and my men's retreats and sang Strength with Heart. And I met Fred Rabinowitz when I joined as a, you know, as I confess, I've been a reluctant joiner. I'm way less reluctant now. But as a 63-year-old, I went and I joined this division at APA, and I started connecting with people, and I went, oh, this is kind of like home. And Fred became an instant brother. Mm-hmm. I met him my first day, you know, when I went to a conference in D.C., and we've been kind of with brothers ever since. And it's a much longer story, but I was telling him about my ideas about Strength with Heart in this book. And anyways, he basically said, hey, what if we do this together? And since he had written or co-written five books and I've struggled, you know, with writing, that's probably a pretty good idea to do that with him. Like, know your weaknesses and compensate for those. You know, and so we've been working on this. It's been quite a creative project, you know, over a number of years right now. But essentially what we've really put together is what we call the guideposts. You know, as opposed to these are rigid ways of looking at things. I was calling them originally the pillars, which seems like very solid and strong, but it's actually not an accurate metaphor. It's much more like when you look out in your life, it's really unclear what you're going to do after breakfast a lot of time, unless you have this meeting, you know what I mean? You don't know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. That's part of life. There's uncertainty is the rule. It's not the exception. And so in life, if you're on a life path, it's good to have a sense of what's poisonous and what's healthy. Like, is that mushroom put? It could be really good.
Yeah. Yeah.
On the other hand, you better be right.
You're dating yourself now. Now you know exactly what the mushroom's going to do.
Right.
Back in the day, not so much.
Right. You know, and so guideposts are a way of kind of looking out when you're on a path and go like, that makes sense to follow that. That it doesn't make sense to go that way. And as someone who's been pretty much a lifelong on trails, like literally backwoods trails, you better pay attention, you know, to your where you are on the trail. And guideposts are a way of helping you stay on the path and not fall off a cliff. And so we've developed these guideposts, which I've been thinking about, and we've kind of honed, you know, together, that are really based on some, you know, I think core life principles. Like one, for example, is courage. You know, now courage, unlike how oftentimes from a male perspective it's seen, is like you just tough it out and you push through. Well, courage is the willingness to do difficult things despite the experience of risk or threat in doing so, based on deeply held core values. And so it may be that you could be perceived as being weak by showing compassion, you know, for example, but because you really believe at the core of your being that compassion is essential for you and for others to express, you do it despite the fact you express it, despite the fact that someone might call you a pansy, you know, or weak, mm-hmm. or something like that, or be seen as less than a strong guy. Mm. So we're like really integrating these and go like, you can be strong. And it actually takes strength, as one of you was elucidating earlier, to express compassion, especially when there is an experience of threat in doing so.
Yeah, I mean, Daniel, you're surely not suggesting that one can be courageous and compassionate at the same time.
For sure. I would never, ever. You know, Chris, I'm really glad that you're able to just tune so deeply in. Wow.
But it's such a, like, that is one of those sort of, like, false narratives that we've been fed, is like those two things can't coexist, right?
Right.
You're either one or you're the other. And that's the thing that we have to erase from our training of young people, especially.
Exactly. It's all part of the binary thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I tell you, most of the time, and I'm not even joking about this, when people ask me, like, do you think it's like this, you know, or this, whatever it happens to be, my response is yes.
Yeah.
And I'm not, you know, and they kind of look and they go, okay, like it's kind of like, oh, wow, they're not in contradiction. We have to understand the difference between a contradiction and a paradox. You know, a paradox is, it can seem on the one level as this is opposed to this, but on a higher level or a deeper level, depending on your frame of reference, they're actually part of the same system. So, for example, I can be super confident, and I am, you know, in certain parts of my life, and really insecure and doubtful in others. I can show up as, you know, I got it. I'm in charge. I know what I'm doing. I can like, what the freak am I doing? I don't know. What do I do in my iPhone? I'm lost. You know, here. Now, the older me, and I think this is part of my own transformation, when I was in my weak states, which happened every day, you know, at different times, I go like, I'm weak. And so that experience would be reflective of my identity, who I was. Mm-hmm. And part of what, you know, Fred and I really, in Strength with Heart, have been really kind of breathing into is the theme of complexity, you know, which is essentially, if you look at a pie chart, you can look at yourself and be like, really on it here? Man, weak here. Need help here. Need help. Oh my God, I gotta ask for help. Mm-hmm. I don't ask for help, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all part of it. And so it's been super freeing, the whole concept and practice of recognizing complexity, and that we have multiple parts of ourselves, different aspects of ourselves that know what we're doing at certain times, and even in the same situation can feel confident at one moment and insecure in another moment, despite that we have the same level of skill in that particular, but we feel differently. What, you woke up on the wrong side of the bed? Mm-hmm. Shaming oneself about that is kind of like breathing in and go and being compelled. Wow, this is hard right now. I don't know where I'm at right now.
Yeah.
And to kind of breathe into that and to recognize that this is part of the human condition, you know, and, you know, I'm not different. I'm human, you know, and may I be kind to myself, you know, in this process of living in this moment, at least.
Yeah, it's funny. I feel like we're all better at self-shame than we are at self-compassion, for sure. But I had written in my notes, and hopefully I'm not making this up, but I don't remember the source. I believe it was you somewhere. This other false binary that is resilience and toughness. Is that something you've spoken about or written about, or because it seems related?
I don't know that I've used exactly those two terms. I have co-created a course with my wife on resilience. And so it's something that I've studied and I know, you know, quite a bit about, and actually am sometimes. But it wasn't me who juxtaposed those words, but tell me what you're thinking about when you're beginning to.
Well, you know, and again, I apologize for not remembering where I saw them or why I wrote them down, but it seems very sort of analogous to strength and compassion, right? Yeah. Like people think that one can't be resilient if one's not tough, right? And that's bogus, right? I mean, like, you know, like, you, go ahead, well, Sean.
Yeah, what is tough? Anyway,
exactly.
I mean, when I think of tough, you know, it's exactly. It's old school, you know, it's, yeah.
But, you know, but on the other hand, just to say in terms of complexity, again, depending on how you define tough, and what does tough mean? What does that mean? I actually do think it's part of resilience, you know, because within the complexity of different things in life, sometimes you got to go like, you know, you're scared out of your freaking mind. You don't know what to do. You're clueless. You're gonna have to deal with this. You're gonna have to step up and deal with this and face it. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's being tough.
Yeah.
You know, and so if toughness, it does not include awareness of threat.
Right. Right.
Or it's you shame yourself into being toughness. It's not the kind of toughness I would value particularly.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I do think that toughness, you know, being able to, you know, handle something, like you want to run a certain amount, you want to push yourself, you want to develop your inner and your outer strength in certain ways, you have to go beyond a certain part of you that's saying, stop, this is too hard.
It's the whole grit.
It is grit.
Perseverance, yeah.
And again, knowing the difference between kind of an injury and just being tired.
Yeah.
You know, like, and that's part of, you know, a certain kind of awareness about it. But yeah.
But that's a balance too of self-compassion to say, okay, well, how far am I going to, you know, I'm going to gut this out and run another mile when in reality, I, you know, should I really, to what end?
Yeah, I think, you know, John Wooden, the UCLA basketball coach, his teams won like 10 national championships in 12 years. I mean, he was amazing. He's got a whole bunch of books on leadership. I love John Wooden.
Yeah.
And one of the things he says, Indiana farm boy wisdom, got from his father, don't let what you can't do get in the way. What was it? Don't let what you can't do get in the way of what you can.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? And my rendition of that is all like, don't let what you won't do get in the way of what you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so there are times when I don't want to exercise or don't want to do something. And what I've learned to do is go like, okay, you don't have to do that.
Right.
Whatever that is, that just feels too ominous at that time, and go do something.
Well, and you know, we don't have time to talk about today, but it's also this whole perspective on strengths and weaknesses and investing in your strengths, you know, and putting more energy into your strengths versus, you know, and I think about reviews, you know, work reviews, right? So it's like, okay, let's go through your strengths and weaknesses, and we're going to try to focus on these traits, which really you're never going to get better at. We're never going to get better at. And would it be better to put all your energy more into the strengths? And how do we funnel someone into being able to utilize those strengths to their best ability, rather than saying, "Oh, we're going to fix these things that you just can't do." I mean, we just can't do. I don't know.
Well, I would say I agree in principle with what you're saying, Sean. The only caveat I would say is that some of those weaknesses also need attention, and depending on, you know, what the context is. So it doesn't mean not paying any, you're not going to get any better at it. You actually can get better. You may not be great at those, but I do agree with that. It is important to breathe into those signature strengths.
Yeah.
You know, and develop.
I agree. Yep.
Yeah. You know, Father Himes, remember Father Himes, Sean, one of his quotes that I loved, I may have mentioned it on that podcast, is like, not everyone's Mother Teresa, right? We're not all meant to go serve the poor of Calcutta. So figure out what you're good at and how you're going to contribute. And, this is another example of a conversation that's for which an hour is not long enough.
Yeah. I mean,
but we're going to be staying in touch.
Whoa, wait a second. I thought this was a day long conversation. So, maybe I missed something.
It is, but it's in
24. What do you mean? We're ending? What are you saying?
It's in 24 parts, is the way we're going to structure it. I do have a bit of a stop. But Daniel, we will be talking to you more. Do you have 5 minutes yourself to answer three questions that we like to ask everybody?
He was planning it all day, so of course.
What are you saying?
Right. Yeah, right.
All right, here we go. Here we go. God, this one flew by.
Yeah.
What happened?
Yeah, I don't know.
The first question, Daniel, is and this is really poignant, I think, given the story that you shared with us, but what do you wish you could have told your 10-year-old self?
Well, the first, the media that popped up was, it's going to be all right. The reassurance.
Mm-hmm.
So many of us go through life with, I'm not okay. it's not going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And it's like this meta message. And I wish I had, you know, had enough wherewithal. And I can understand why I didn't. So I can have compassion for that kid who just didn't have any, you know, great messages and guidance, you know, there. But it's okay. And, you know, life is a journey. You may have heard that one before, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Second question, Daniel, is do you have a mantra in life or a mantra these days?
I don't know that I have one per se, but I think that I try to keep expanding my frame of reference, you know, because there's a part of the brain that's called the default mode network, which is kind of where we are tend to ruminate from. And I have great capacities there, a lot of skill and a lot of experience, you know, there where I can anxietize. I like to make up words in there. And so if I had to have a mantra that I actually said, I'd say, like, you know, expand your consciousness, really. And that sounds trite in a way, expand your consciousness. I don't normally say it to myself in that regard, but it's like just have a larger frame of reference. Ooh. You know, because I know that, like, I've gone through some physical stuff more, and I am recently. I'm in a much better place psychologically now, you know, with that, because I just kind of work with it, and it's kind of like, okay, let go. Mm-hmm. You got to let go, and don't catastrophize, and just, I don't know what the future holds. And just, like, in this moment, I'm good. You know, and when you start expanding out, like, oh my God, I'm going to die somewhere. Like, you're freaking right, you are going to. You don't know when that's going to happen. And get over, just chill out. And it's, you know, it's not such a beautiful day looking out, but there's beautiful trees out there. Open up to that. Open up to beauty.
That sort of having a larger frame of reference is actually helpful to me right now in this moment. So I definitely appreciate that.
Cool.
The last question we'd like to ask you is, what do you hope that people will say about you at your wake?
You know, I had this idea for a title for a memoir that was, "He Got Over Himself."
Oh.
But when I said that to a friend some years ago, he said to me, "Well, I think it should be a little different than that." He said to me, but he was getting over himself. By the way, I just want to say, like, we've been playing also. We've kind of messed around and like this. And Sean and I have done that many times. I think this is one of the things that guys do much more than women do. And I don't know if it's by a lot. I don't know exactly what that is. If you look at male, you know, rams, they kind of ram up against each other. We have to be able to use each other to push off against in ways, because it's part of how we develop ourselves. And I think there's been a lot of shaming from women, you know, around this, and from other guys, you shouldn't be doing that. Like that, like, just some of this stuff, new agey, like that, there's something wrong with that. And I think that's BS. I think that's wrong. It's wrongheaded. And I think we need to be able to play this way. The difference is when we're shaming each other and we do it in this old unconscious way, or that we get hurt and don't say something about that. You know, because to me, being able to do this and poke and prod and stuff, and did that hurt? Okay, I'm sorry about that. But, you know, to try and not do that, you know, is wrongheaded. Mm-hmm. And so I've appreciated you two, you know, and being able to do this and be playful about it and be serious about it. And this is all part of the complexity of who we are as human male beings.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for saying that. And I wish you continued luck in trying to get over yourself.
Believe me, I spent time with him, and it's a long, as he said, it's a journey. But I give him plenty of space.
Sean,
for that.
You hurt my feelings.
I give him plenty of space for that. It's just fine.
Well, and I also want to say that I'm pretty sure that people will say much nicer, bigger things about you at your wake, which hopefully is not for 40 years, but I feel like you're leaving a mark in a positive way.
Yeah, for sure. I know I feel loved and loving despite my own fears about myself. I've reached a point in my own evolution where I know that's the case, and he was inspirational and he made a difference. Positive difference, that is.
For sure.
So nice to connect with you. We will definitely do it again. Next time, facial hair is required for everybody.
Well, I think this, when you and Fred finally get the book out, we'll have, you know, both of you come on, we'll talk about the book and dig into the guideposts in more detail, and he could talk about how he did 90% of the work. And we'll do that.
Appreciate what you guys are doing at MedLiving. I think it's a fantastic service, and I look forward to being more involved with MedLiving as the time goes on.
Amen. As are we.
This is Chris. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of If You've Come This Far.
And this is Sean. Remember to check us out at MedLiving.org.